Hi, I'm Sabrina Philippe-Don, and I was diagnosed with autism when I was about 5. People who are diagnosed with autism have better functioning skills, they can learn better, and they can see themselves in a more reactive way than other people would. Other people can learn from me that as much as I would have autism, I usually go beyond with what's said in the environment.
Hi, my name is Doreen Saletti and I'm Sabrina's mom. Autism is a really complex, it's really a complex thing, and it involves some subtleties and some really specific differences. So, you know, for instance, social and communication areas are affected across the board pretty much with autism. And so that means in terms of speech, Sabrina has always had great receptive language, but expressive language, trying to pull the right words to respond, or auditory processing delays where sometimes it will take her a little bit longer to come up with a response. And you know, with adults are patient, we tend to wait a little bit more in terms of having conversations. But with her peers, you know, in school, that was always a big challenge because they're on to the third topic by the time she's responding to the first. And so those kinds of delays, you know, really were an issue for her. And they, with all of the services that she's been able to receive, that's really helped. She's, you know, gone through a social skills program that she continues to work with, a speech and language program at Duquesne University that's helped tremendously, a number of other kinds of activities, some community activities, in-stride therapeutic riding, getting involved with horseback riding and also volunteering with the program has helped in the social and communication areas as well. But those are some of the things that are affected. And I think people don't always understand that, you know, when you're diagnosed with autism, it doesn't mean you're not smart. It just means that you perceive the world a little bit differently. At least, and I'm speaking from my experience as Sabrina, because, you know, it is a spectrum, so there are quite a range of different you know, affectations that happen to people on the spectrum. But in her case, she really perceives the world a little bit differently. And sometimes I feel like an interpreter and helping to make sure she understands a question or understands a situation so she can move forward more independently. But it's been a really interesting journey.
It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. April is Autism Awareness Month. And if you or your child has autism, you've likely heard of the DSM, published by the American Psychiatric Association. DSM stands for the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual, and the main purpose of the manual is to provide standard guidelines for clinicians to use when diagnosing psychological disorders and conditions. The manual outlines criteria that must be met to receive a diagnosis, as well as labeling and coding, sometimes used by insurance companies to identify the diagnosis. With all that said, the DSM is periodically revised, and this spring, new revisions to the manual will be published. Dr. Catherine Lord is the director of the Center for Autism and the Developing Brain, a subsidiary of Weill Cornell Medical College and New York Presbyterian Hospital. She's also part of the work group that developed the DSM revisions and joins us by phone. Dr. Lord, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh. And I understand we are in the process of getting her on the phone, so I will mention to you, our listeners, that if you have a comment or question for our guest, you can join the conversation at 412-246-2002. That's 412-246-2002. Our email address is esspgh@wesa.fm, and you can reach us on Twitter at esspgh and follow the conversation at #EPLive. What concerns do you have about changes to the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual? 412-246-2002 is the number to call. And also joining us on the program today is a woman who has been doing research at Duquesne University and will be joining us to talk about how to improve communication between parents and their autistic children. Dr. Rachel Robertson will be joining us in the second half of the program. And in fact, we're going to bring her on right now because she's with us in studio, planning to listen in on this first segment. So we're going to involve you in the conversation right away, Dr. Robertson. It's a conversation about autism spectrum disorders with Dr. Rachel Robertson, a behavioral analyst and professor in the Duquesne University School of Education. She's studying behavior and communication in families with children on the autism spectrum, but not just the children. Dr. Robertson is especially interested in working with African-American families, and she joins us to talk about her work. Rachel Robertson, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh.
Thanks very much for having me.
And again, our number, if you'd like to join the conversation, 412-246-2002. Dr. Robertson, this sounds like fascinating research, and I'm very curious about what you've learned as you've delved into it.
Well, there's actually a number of decades of research that have been completed so far on the role of communication with difficult behavior with children with autism, which is really what I focus on. And in the big picture, what we've learned is that communication and difficult behavior are very intertwined in children with autism because so many of them don't develop language or communication on time or have delayed language and often learn, you know, difficult behavior is the best method I have of communicating my needs and getting them met because I don't have the language that a typical child might have.
So when an autistic child acts out, it's that child's way of communicating, of saying to their parents, I need your attention. I may not be sure exactly how to communicate my needs, but here I am. Help me.
Right. So it's not always the case, but often the case that they might be communicating, you know, no, I don't want to do this. Leave me alone. Or, you know, I do need your attention. I need help. Or I want that toy or something like that. And a really important thing for both parents and teachers is to try to figure out, is my child's behavior communicating a consistent message and what is that message? And then do they have another way of communicating the same thing that is maybe more appropriate or more safe that I can respond to and help them use more consistently?
How often does this kind of interaction go on between a parent and a child before they may even realize that their child is autistic?
That's a really good question. We actually don't have a lot of research yet about at what age these difficult behaviors tend to emerge in a lot of children with autism. I think often they emerge around the same time or a little bit after the child is diagnosed. So diagnosis often happens between like the ages of 2 and 3. And some children will show difficult behaviors even before that. Like they might hurt themselves is something that some children engage in. So that can happen before they're diagnosed, and that might be a red flag.
You mean hurt themselves, you're talking about intentionally to get attention.
Yeah, it's usually called self-injurious behavior and comes in a lot of forms. And again, people don't know exactly what's going on or why some children engage in that behavior, but we do know that often it's conveying a message, like I was saying before, and that may be that the child has learned this is a really effective way of getting people to come help me and pay attention to me, or this is a really effective way of getting people to back off and leave me alone and not make me put on my clothes or something that I really don't want to do. And I don't have the words to say it like a typical kid would.
If you are the parent of an autistic child, we'd love to hear your stories about how your communication is with your child, how it's improved, or if there are ways that you're searching for to improve your communication with your autistic child. You can call us at 412-246-2002. Again, 412-246-2002, the number to call. And our email address, esspgh@wesa.fm. Dr. Robertson, I want to get back to some of your research, but I also understand that we do have Dr. Lord on the phone with us as well, and we will join her now from New York. Dr. Lord, welcome. Catherine Lord, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh.
Hi, how are you?
Good, thank you. And again, Dr. Lord is director of the Center for Autism and the Developing Brain and joins us by phone from New York. Dr. Lord, how much has the recognition of autism spectrum disorders improved in the past couple of decades?
I think it's improved a great deal. The primary force, I think, is really parents who are much more aware that autism exists and that we can do something about it, that we can give families help, and that it isn't just a terrible term that's used with a child, but something that describes behaviors and that can be changed. So I think, you know, 40 years ago or even 20 years ago, you know, I would describe to somebody what I did and they would say, oh, do you mean artistic? Or they would say, oh, you know, I've never heard of autism. Or they would just say, you know, autism, is that the Rain Man? But I think that more and more the public is much, much more aware of the fact that autism exists, that it comes in a range of forms. It sounded like you were already talking about this with Dr. Robertson.
Yes.
And And also that there are things we can do that we can really help and make a difference.
And how much is the increased awareness of autism simply based on the fact that there are so many more children in the United States and around the world, for that matter, who are being diagnosed with it?
Well, I think those two things go hand in hand. And what causes what, we're not sure. I mean, I think that many of those children probably had the diagnosis or had autism already, and nobody knew exactly what to call it. But I think as we become more and more aware of it, people are beginning to think, oh, this child, that's what's going on with this child, as opposed to thinking this child just is disobeying people or is very difficult or just very unsocial, but if he could just try harder, he'd snap out of it.
Now, I mentioned at the top of the segment the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual being periodically revised, and this spring, new revisions to the manual will be published. With regard to those revisions on autism spectrum disorders, why was it necessary, why is it necessary to revise the diagnosis?
Well, I think the goal, I mean, first of all, we started with the APA or the American Psychiatric Association takes a look, sort of revisits all diagnoses for developmental disorders and any kind of mental health problem periodically. And so it had been almost 20 years since the last volume. And so then the question was, do we really need to change things? And I was on the committee, and there was a committee of 17 people appointed to consider this. And the first thing that we thought was that the current criteria, the ones that will change in May, were very confusing, and that often people didn't understand what was the difference between autism and Asperger's syndrome and PDD-NOS, and that children were moving sometimes from diagnosis to diagnosis, depending on which doctor they saw, and that sometimes kids were denied services. They were told, well, if you have Asperger's, you can't have services, or we only serve children with Asperger's. We don't serve children with autism, when in fact the same child might have multiple diagnoses. So I think our primary focus was to try to make things clearer and make sure that professionals and parents were on the same page.
What does social communication disorder break down to mean?
Well, I think that there's a new disorder that's proposed, which is pragmatic social communication disorder. And it's really there to try to pick up kids who don't have autism, but who have difficulty communicating with other people, who have language problems, but not because they don't know words or they don't know how to make sentences, but they don't know how to sort of take turns and talk to people. So it overlaps with autism, but it doesn't include any kind of repetitive behavior or difficulty with sensations or sensory input or getting stuck on things. And we really don't know how many kids will have it. It may be a very, very small number of kids that fit into that criteria. And we want to be sure that it's not used as sometimes PDD-NOS or Asperger's were used to mean basically autism, but with more hope, because that really backfired in the sense of sometimes getting people into situations where they couldn't get the help that they needed because they were given a diagnosis that really sort of avoided the point that this really was autism. We don't want pragmatic communication disorder used in that way, but so we need to be very careful.
I think that a lot of the way that a lot of us understand the difference between Asperger's and autism is that the children who have autism tend to be more withdrawn. And the symptom that you were describing of the overlapping conversation seems to be associated more with the Asperger's. Is that correct?
Well, I think that many people use Asperger's in many different ways. I think the most common way that it was used was to describe more able kids who had autism but were verbally fluent. And then in some cases, not everywhere, but in some cases, more socially active. But one of the problems with Asperger's is, for example, Simon Baron-Cohen, who is one of the experts in the field in Cambridge, England, uses it to mean very, very bright but very socially withdrawn people. So it's used in different ways by different people, and that's one of the reasons we felt like it's better to get it out of this sort of scientific terminology. And if people want to use it, you know, to describe a group or describe themselves, that's fine. But because it's used in so many different ways, it really is a source of confusion.
Our guest is Dr. Catherine Lord. She is the director of the Center for Autism and the Developing Brain, a subsidiary of Weill Cornell Medical College and New York Presbyterian Hospital. She's also part of the work group that developed the DSM revisions, joining us by phone from New York. And we'll continue our conversation with her as well as Dr. Rachel Robertson after we take this break. It's Essential Pittsburgh on 90.5 WESA. It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. We're talking about the upcoming revision of the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders with Dr. Catherine Lord. She is director of the Center for Autism and the Developing Brain, a subsidiary of Weill Cornell Medical College and New York Presbyterian Hospital. She's with us by phone. And also with us in studio is Dr. Rachel Robertson, a behavioral analyst and professor in the Duquesne University School of Education. She's studying behavior and communication in families with children on the autism spectrum and how to improve that communication or learn ways that it can be improved. And if you have comments or questions, you can join the conversation by calling us at 412-246-2002. That's 412-246-2002. Our email address is essspgh@wesa.fm. And you can reach us on Twitter at ESSPGH and follow the conversation at #EPLive. Again, we'd like to know what concerns you have about changes to the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual, and we'd like you to share your stories with us if you're a parent of an autistic child. We'd like to hear from you at 412-246-2002. Dr. Lord, I want to go back to you and talk a little bit about the revision, the upcoming revision of the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders. And I think a lot of people are probably curious about why create a new term instead of keeping high-functioning people in the autism spectrum.
Well, I think one of the things that's happened is that even in DSM-4, our group, I was involved in DSM-4 as well, and our group proposed that instead of the overall category of pervasive developmental disorders, we would use the term autism spectrum disorders. But because of the editing of the aspect of the manual, they didn't want to change any of the headings. And so we were told, no, we had to stick with this overall term of pervasive developmental disorders. So technically, that is what the overall category is. And then within that fell autism, Asperger's, and PDD-NOS, as well as a number of other disorders associated with very specific genetic abnormalities like Fragile X and Rett syndrome. One of the proposals that our group made was that we wanted to separate out autism as a behavioral diagnosis from the genetics, because many kids people may find different genetic risk factors that contribute to their autism. They may not cause it by itself. But also, most of those genetic findings aren't directly linked to autism. It isn't that if you've got that genetic finding, you always have autism. So we wanted to be able to just recognize and be straightforward in saying, basically, autism is a behavioral diagnosis. It has to do with your behaviors at the time that we're looking at you. And then you may or may not have a genetic finding like Fragile X, or you may or may not have seizures, or you may or may not have other disorders like ADHD or anxiety or depression as an adult. We then were concerned that, as I said, there was so much confusion within that whole heading of pervasive developmental disorders about what was PDD-NOS, what was Asperger's, what was autism. And really, the only agreement we could get was that generally Asperger's was better. It was better to have Asperger's than to have autism, except if you were looking for services. And if you were trying to get help, often autism was a better term. And PDD-NOS sort of floated around there in the middle. And so when we looked carefully at the research, it was clear that what we have is we have individual kids and adults, who each of whom is different and each of whom varies on a lot of different dimensions that include how severe are the social deficits. Is the person very outgoing but sometimes inappropriate or more withdrawn? Is the person very bothered by different sensations such as noises or textures, or is that something that's not important to them? Are they somebody who is really thrown off if there are changes or not bothered by changes? And there's so much variability within that, but that variability seemed more important to us than these terms like Asperger's and PDD-NOS and autism. In addition, many people with autism, but not all, have language delays, and a significant minority also have intellectual disabilities, or what used to be called mental retardation. And so we felt like if we really wanted to describe individual kids and individual adults, it made more sense to say, look, we should know all of these things about you. We should know, are you someone who's got really good language, but who has, a learning disability in terms of visual spatial skills? Are you someone who is very socially withdrawn, but who actually is pretty flexible, but is bothered by loud noises? And those descriptions are what's going to make the biggest difference. And we felt like it's better to lay out ways of making those descriptions than to have these sort of categorical subtypes like PDD-NOS, Asperger syndrome, and autism.
And explain, if you would, why the idea of the routine creates a comfort level in many individuals who have autism, for example. Why that is a comforting notion?
Well, I think it's a number of different factors. I think probably all of us at some time or other like routines, but I think that part of it is that if you don't pick up social cues, if you don't understand the subtleties, for example, of people's facial expressions, of people's changes in tones of voice, you often don't know what's going to happen. You don't know if the next thing that's going to happen is going to be good or bad. You don't know how long this is going to continue. I think for kids with autism, many of them focus on routines that make sense to them. And then when that makes sense and other things, for example, the social world doesn't make sense, they're literally saying, wait a minute, I want to go back to, always parking in the same spot. And where a typical child might be focusing on, well, my mother's facial expression looks worried because she can't get into the parking place, so I'm not going to protest now because I know she's upset, a child with autism might not realize that, and they're just focused on that parking place. The good thing is that I think often we can use that desire for routines in a positive way to help kids learn to do things. We can help kids expand their routines, and later, even as adults, the fact that they like routines may be very helpful as an employee.
Joining us on the phone, Dr. Catherine Lord, Director of the Center for Autism and the Developing Brain, and also with us, Dr. Rachel Robertson, who is a behavioral analyst and professor in the Duquesne University School of Education. Our number, 412-246-2002. Let's go to Wendy in Pittsburgh. Wendy, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh.
Thank you so much for taking my call. The reason I'm calling today is from the time I had the first suspicion until the diagnosis was 9 months. I went to our PCP, then they sent us to the county IUI for evaluation, then they sent us to the UPMC Children's Hospital Autism Unit. Because of those long wait times, it was 9 months. When we got to the Children's Hospital Autism Unit, the diagnostician there didn't speak to my son or observe him. She simply diagnosed him based on my notes. Then she handed me some Medicaid forms and told me that I would need to fill out those forms before I could receive services, and I was sent out on my way. It was up to me to learn about wraparound and any services or find doctors that could help him. I feel like the label of autism is how we get the insurance, and then it's up to the parents to find out the best services for their child. From a parent's perspective, we need that autism label so we can get our child the help, because without that label, you're done. You can't get wraparound. You can't get a lot of services that you need.
Well, and you raise a good question, and I would defer to either Dr. Lord or Dr. Robertson, and that is for people who fall under the new social communication disorder diagnosis, how will services be affected by the change in terms?
Actually, I couldn't hear the question, but do you want me to plunge in and try to answer that?
Yes. Yes, and that was Wendy in Pittsburgh, okay. And sorry you weren't able to hear her question, okay. But essentially that she's talking about when you go to the doctor's office her son was diagnosed or child was diagnosed based on the notes and her comments provided in notes given to a doctor who did not actually examine or speak with her child directly.
So I think that's first a problem because I think that it is one of the things we do know is that diagnoses need to both take into account what a parent says and the description of the child, but also a child needs to be seen by someone who is experienced in the field of autism, who deals with the child directly and has a chance to see what the child can and can't do. So more than just, you know, a quick office visit, you know, sitting on an exam table. So I think that does make it harder. The pragmatic communication or pragmatic social communication disorder doesn't fall in the autism category, so it is treated as a communication disorder. So I think that the way that may affect services is it may mean that a child would be eligible for services for communication, but not necessarily the behavioral kinds of treatments that many children with autism get and benefit from. I think the other thing to remember and what we've been trying to say to families is that if you look at the potential list of repetitive behaviors and the kinds of repetitive and sensory behaviors that are in autism, there are four different general headings. Almost all of us, everyone in the world, at some point or other, has had some kind of repetitive behavior. And so the reason that two are required for autism is because one is so common. But if you look at them carefully and don't treat them as bad things, just treat them as, yes, my child did line things up, or my child is really bothered by textures of food, then that may be very helpful for the person making the diagnosis. But you do need a really good interview that gives the family a chance to describe what the child is like, and then someone does need to see the child in order to have a reliable diagnosis.
Let's go to Zoe in Swissvale. Again, our number, 412-246-2002. Zoe, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh.
Hi. I just want to say I have a 9-year-old boy, and he's diagnosed PDD-NOS. And just wanted to say, no matter what comes out with the DSM-5, I really agree with the last caller about the services, you know, being this very nebulous process. One of the things you find with a kid with on this spectrum, you find that, again, when you do an IEP, that's an individualized educational plan. And you know, the thing is, I don't care what you want to label it as. Yes, you do need the label to get the services, but the way it manifests is so individualized. You can't say when any particular kid's, you know, abilities, weaknesses, or what their focus areas are going to be. It's a broad spectrum disorder. And also, I'd like to say that getting wraparound services is getting harder because of all the cuts that they're making to special education budgets right now. And I try not to, you know, get politicized about it, but these services are becoming more and more in need. And as a parent with a child, I think about what he's going to be like 18 or 19. How independent is he going to be? And what services, if we're cutting things now out of special education, out of wraparound, what is going to be available for him to transition? You're going to have, in about 10 years, this whole group of kids, as these numbers keep increasing, who are transitioning to young adulthood, and how independent are they going to be? I mean, are we going to have group homes? Are there going to be, you know, services and homes and organizations help them transition with what kind of needs they might have to function, you know.
It's a great question. And mm-hmm. And 10 years from now, many of the 8- and 9-year-old children who have autism may very well need those support services. So I would put that question to Dr. Lord or Dr. Robertson. What about the cuts? What is it that an autistic child, as they transition to becoming an adult and perhaps trying to live on their own, attend a college, that kind of thing or get specialized training. What support services do they need, and what if they are cut to the point where they're not getting what they need?
I think it's very important to try to recognize that on the whole, autism doesn't completely go away. I mean, there are people who really do move beyond it, but they're rare cases, and they're there because of the support they received. So I think that we don't want to, for a while, I think people thought, well, if we get everybody early intervention, the kids will be cured by the time they're 5 or 7 and on their way. And the reality is that many, many more adults are becoming independent and living much better lives, but that is because of the help that they received. And generally, that help continues in some ways through high school and even into college and into getting people jobs sometimes. I think there we need to focus on immediate practical outcomes. So, what are the skills that a boy going to high school needs? What is it that he isn't doing that would help him, enjoy high school and benefit academically? Does he need help in organization? Does he need help in making friends? Does he need help in finding, positive things that he can do just as we would any other student? And often students with autism can benefit from the same things. I mean, being involved in music or art or sports or extracurricular activities, because that gives them the same social contact that other students, and maybe even more important. I think going to college, often organizational skills make a huge difference. And the reason that many students with autism struggle in college is not that they're not smart enough, but that just, getting up in the morning and figuring out what work they need to do can be very tough, but that's also something that we can help a great deal with. And I think the same thing with getting a job. I really feel like many, many people with autism can be very successfully employed, but we have to find somebody who, especially in this economy, who will give them a chance. We also have to make sure that they have some skills, they have something to offer, so that there are people that would want to hire them. And they can do that, but it doesn't necessarily happen on its own. And what's hard for the parents is it means that they, it's hard enough having a regular teenager, but that they have to both be able to step back and give their child independence, but they have to also figure out how to help their child have that independence and if necessary, bring in other people or have more specific targeted sort of behavioral goals of how am I going to make sure that my son really does take a decent shower with me without me hopping in there in the shower with him. And, how am I going to make sure that my daughter gets organized to get her homework done without me being the one who does it all the time because I don't want to go to college with her.
Right, right. These services and supports are very, very necessary. We're talking with Dr. Catherine Lord. She is the director of the Center for Autism and the Developing Brain, a subsidiary of Weill Cornell Medical College and New York Presbyterian Hospital. And also with us is Dr. Rachel Robertson, behavioral analyst and professor in the Duquesne University School of Education. We were talking about some of the research that you were doing, Dr. Robertson, studying behavior and communication in families with children on the autism spectrum. You were focusing in particular on four volunteer families, African-American families. And I'm curious as to what some of the strategies that your families are now using to communicate better?
Well, primarily those strategies have involved using some type of visual support with the child in combination with identifying, what is the positive behavior that we really want to see more of out of our child and what is that difficult behavior that we want to see less of, and making sure that they're really reinforcing that positive behavior and maybe not paying any attention to that negative behavior or doing some kind of different consequence so that the child learns, A, what's going to happen is visually communicated to them so it makes sense to them, and then B, engaging in positive behavior is more effective at meeting their needs than engaging in that difficult behavior.
From what I've read, it sounds like the best approach tends to be visual.
Visual plus, as a behavior analyst, I would say approaches that use applied behavior analysis have a lot of research support. So I definitely personally try to engage both in some kind of applied behavior analysis approach that really targets, you know, what are the interactions that are going on in the environment with the child, be it either a teacher or a parent, you know, what's the consequence to the child engaging in a difficult behavior? Do they tend to benefit from it in some way? Because a lot of times kids learn, you know, what the best thing for me to do to get my needs met is to engage in difficult behavior. And that's how I get the attention I need and the help I need and communicate what I need to others. So if I see, you know, that that's the kind of interactions that are going on, then it becomes sort of like, what can we change in how parents and teachers interact with the child to really be supportive of positive behavior and make these sort of problematic behaviors less efficient or work less well for the child? And then I do try to also implement some kind of visual support, because many children with autism have strengths in the visual area, and that tends to be helpful.
And you've worked as a behavioral consultant in classrooms. How could some of your techniques extend to the classroom?
Well, I would say a lot of classrooms these days that focus on children with autism do incorporate visual supports. So visual schedules are very common for children with autism, and that's something that I have found to be very effective. There's a lot of research support for, they're called activity schedules, if you look those up. And at the same time, a behavior analytic approach or applied behavior analysis has become very common in schools when we talk about children with difficult behavior, which a lot of children with autism have difficult behavior, in terms of if a child in school has some kind of difficult behavior that's interfering with their learning, then the teachers actually need to conduct what's called a functional behavior assessment and figure out what message that behavior is sending, like we were talking about before. You know, what is the child kind of communicating through their behavior, and what are strategies we can use as teachers to prevent the misbehavior, to give the child other means of getting their needs met? And then they have to create a behavior support plan from all of that information. So that really comes out of the research that's been done in applied behavior analysis. So both of those tools, I would say, are to varying degrees being used in schools today pretty regularly.
Doreen on Twitter asks, how might the DSM changes impact adults on the autism spectrum?
We hope that they will help. I mean, we really tried to write the criteria so that there are examples for each of the main principles that are appropriate for adults, not just for kids. And we also tried to, one of the focuses of the criteria are that rather than sort of mix up examples, like in DSM-4, you have a child isn't supposed to share enjoyment, and a child isn't supposed to have peer relations. But then you have statements like poor social reciprocity. And what we tried to do in DSM-5 is have broader statements like poor social reciprocity, poor nonverbal communication, and then difficulties with relationships or adjusting behavior to social context, and make it clear that those were the general principles, and that it's really up to the clinician or a parent or a person with autism to think of examples that fall under that principle. And we hope that that will better include adults, so that you won't have people saying, you know, this adult can't have autism because they do have eye contact, when in fact the person has developed better eye contact through real work.
We are out of time for this segment, but I want to thank both of our guests for sharing their insights about autism with us. Dr. Catherine Lord, director of the Center for Autism and the Developing Brain, a subsidiary of Weill Cornell Medical College and New York Presbyterian Hospital. Dr. Lord, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
And also Dr. Rachel Robertson joining us in studio. She's a behavioral analyst and professor in the Duquesne University School of Education. Dr. Robertson, thank you for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you.